Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Deeper Podcast, our first podcast of the new year. It is great to be here. I'm Austin Slater. That's Dan Kinnis. And I do want to apologize that I sound like I swallowed sandpaper. I've been sick for the last 2 or 3 weeks, but we're making our way through it, getting better. And Dan, it is so good to be back with you. How was your holidays?
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be with you again, Austin. Been a couple of weeks, like you said, since we recorded. Holidays were good. We had a little time with family, both sides, and a little bit of travel and to see them. And then, some time just at home. Our kids had the 2 full weeks off of school this year, which isn't always the case. So
it was a long break. Yeah. I know. I don't have kids in school, but I took most of those 2 weeks as holiday for myself. And wow, you never realize how much time is in 2 weeks until you have 2 weeks where you're not doing anything.
Yeah. Even with some of the get-togethers and that, time feels quite a bit different in that setting. So no, it was good, but good to be back here with everybody listening and going deeper into some of the things we talked about on Sunday. So
yeah, well, we did just start up a new series. We finished our Advent series, and we're now starting our Advent series.
That's right.
I'm looking at this second Advent, and specifically in Revelation. And Revelation is an incredibly complicated book, and so I wanted to take a moment before we dive into anything else specifically about this sermon to just kind of talk about the genres of the book of Revelation, because I feel like that's kind of important for us to understand. Because there is a major shift in this book about like 7 or 8 chapters in. You'll notice it changes. And so I was wondering if you could just kind of summarize, like, what are these genres we're dealing with? Why does it shift so suddenly? And why is that important for us to keep in mind?
Yeah, that is a good thing to talk about and be aware of. So largely, when you think about Revelation, you think about apocryphal writing, which a lot of it is. And even, of course, that's often been a title for the book in the past, you know, the Apocrypha, you know, kind of apocalypse, I should say, not the, so it has that kind of writing to it, the apocalyptic kind of style. When we get into all the imagery, like you said, especially the chapters kind of after the part we've been in, a lot of the imagery and the symbols and the numbers, and very rich too with Old Testament connections. But a lot of it's, how do you describe the culmination of all things? And the apocalyptic language speaks into, it gives a way to speak into that using some different images, these grand scales that we don't have things to describe. So that's a big chunk of what Revelation is, but it's not all of it. When we are in chapter 3 here, these are closer actually in form to some of the epistles, right? The letters of Paul or Peter, whoever it might be. And these are really, a lot of times they're classified as sermons that Jesus is giving to each of these particular churches there in Turkey. So a little different style. You get some imagery in that, but it's quite a bit different from even when we get to chapter 4 in 2 weeks, some of the imagery you're getting there. All of a sudden, here's all these creatures and you're at the throne of God. And how do you describe that? And what's that look like? And a little bit different here. You probably can read this chapter 3, what we did this week, much more along the lines of, if you went to 1 Thessalonians or something like that, Jesus kind of writing a letter to or giving a sermon to his church. And so it's important that as we read that, you see these very close connections with the church that he's writing to. And when we talk about Sardis or Philadelphia or next week Laodicea, you can see Jesus knows all about that city, all about that church, and he's speaking specifically to them. Not that there's nothing for us today. There certainly is, but there is a close tie. This is not just imagery that's pointing to something else. This is, Sardis, you need to wake up, just like you had in your city multiple times when you weren't guarding your Acropolis and somebody took that over. Right? There's a very clear tie-in that they would have been well aware of. So much more concrete connections. The apocalyptic writing is pointing to things, but in a different kind of way. You know, it's more in a broader sense than the very, very specific. And that's where sometimes when we're reading the rest of Revelation, where we can get off track, we want to make it very specific.
I remember my first few times reading Revelation. Now, granted, I was a kid and had no training in how to read this, but I remember my first few times reading through it. I was just reading through it as if it were the same thing. And I'm like, and here's the books, and then this demon coming out with 7 heads. And I'm like, wow, that's a tone shift.
What do I do with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And that is, it's not a writing style we employ commonly today either. So if we were around at that time, it was much more common. And so you would be used to that kind of writing and imagery. Some of the intertestamental books or the apocryphal books we've seen use a lot of this language too. So again, the people were much more familiar with that. It had become kind of almost the norm writing style in a lot of ways for some of describing these kind of things, what God was doing. For us now, yeah, I mean, even we talk about fantasy. That's like the closest we get to some of this. And we're like, well, we know it's not that. So what is this stuff? Mm-hmm. Like, how are we supposed to read it? So it is God communicating truth to us, but it's a different fashion. He's trying to get at these big movements, big things he's doing, calling us to persevere. Again, the overall message is important to get. God is victorious. He's bringing about his plan. There is resistance to that, and he's calling us to be faithful and to persevere in the midst of it. But yes, yeah, no, it's good to talk about it a bit even and get into it.
And even just to highlight it, because then eventually whenever we do, if ever we do get into some of those later books, then we can be like, oh yes, this is a different genre. Mm-hmm. I can read this differently. So just good to have in mind. Now, with that being said, I guess, Dan, what did we talk about specifically this last Sunday?
Mm-hmm. So with this kind of Second Advent series, we're talking about, we're obviously waiting for Christ's return. Well, how do we wait? How do we live as we long for his return, as we're looking toward that? And so we used two of the churches in Jesus speaks to in Revelation 3, Sardis and Philadelphia, to get into that a bit. And in Sardis's case, largely how are we maybe not supposed to go about it? It's a pretty negative message to that church. There's nothing commendable that Jesus says about them, other than there's a few of you that haven't soiled your clothes. Not exactly a great compliment. And then Philadelphia, which is much on the other side, there's no complaint Jesus gives about that church. He usually does with almost all the other churches. So that is more the positive. Oh, this is what faithful waiting looks like, and the perseverance there that is shown in the Philadelphia church. So we just kind of, from that overview of thinking about Christ's return, looked into those churches, talked a little bit about those history and how Jesus speaks into that, but then also thinking about, yeah, these issues or positive responses in Philadelphia's case, they're still with us today, and it's still relevant, and we need to think about it. So, yeah, complacency, the big negative on the side of Sardis, perseverance, the big positive on the side of Philadelphia.
Yeah, and like with all things, we can kind of, we have periods where we're both. We have periods of complacency and periods of this intentionality and this, it's really interesting. I thought it was so interesting how we talked about, like, historically, these cities were established around the same time, similar approaches, and yet they went such different ways with respect to how the church developed and had influence. And, you know me, I like to think on, okay, let's talk big scale picture. How does this relate to now? And I thought it was really interesting because I feel like, at least as you look at the historical interactions with this, I feel like the church in the United States, up until maybe even as recently as 10 years ago, could have had at least some of the levels of influence and cultural comfort that the church in Sardis has. I mean, when you look at, or had, I should say, when you look at, we have never had a president who was not a believer, at least nominally. You know, all of our, I mean, heck, there's a church on every corner. On our corner, there is three.
Right, right.
And so here in the United States, we as Christians have been able to get very comfortable with having influence and say, and we are, as Christians, we are not currently a minority. And it's just one of those things that I can see a world where we can potentially fall into this Sardis attitude, where we're just like, this is how it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not going to really try and be uncomfortable and make us grow, because why would we give up this? Mm-hmm. And then, so as I was thinking about that, I was like, okay, so that's the grand scale. And I think we can see this on the grand scale. We can see that, you know, the church has kind of been stagnating. We're almost every denomination is losing members year after year. And so we're maybe moving into this period where we're starting to have the cultural influence of Philadelphia, which is honestly probably great, because we're supposed to be more like the Church of Philadelphia than we are the Church of Sardis.
That situation, yeah.
I was wondering, to bring this out of the big picture level now to a more local level, complacency is really the thing that gets us. And when we've been, in the same place doing the same thing for so long, we get complacent. All of us do that. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, and I know this is a hard question to ask, kind of put you on the spot here, but like here at Friendship or even just in West Michigan, can you identify any ways we might be becoming complicit? I mean, we've been – West Michigan has been CRC since the CRC was. Mm-hmm. Friendship has been around now for 50 years?
Yeah, not quite that.
Not quite.
A little over 35.
You know what? I'm still recovering from a fever, so that's what we're going to blame that memory on. But yeah, so just, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, and it is unique, even in the country, right? You said, like, overall, the United States has been typically pretty favorable toward Christianity and welcoming, and there's been that, you know, practice of it going on. But if you're in different areas, it might be feel different, right? Even in, you know, my lifetime, if you were in the heart of New York City at a church there, you might get quite a bit different response versus being in West Michigan or somewhere else, right? And so they're different churches might have experienced this different way. Or if you're a suburban Caucasian person like myself, and that's the makeup of your church versus being an inner city minority church, right? Different feels perhaps. But for us here, you know, I think there has been a great deal of comfort, right? And for a lot of years, especially in the CRC, we haven't really had to work very hard to have members join our church. Or, you know, we just have a lot of kids and we had more people for a while that were immigrating even. And so it's kind of like, oh, yeah, this is just how it goes. And you can become very stagnant or just kind of complacent. Like, yeah, it looks like we got this pretty well figured out, and not really be paying attention to then what are some of the things that are coming in that are a little bit dangerous here. And there's even, you know, often been, not as much now, but hey, a lot of the people, even the Reformed Church, like they're very similar to us. It's not like this whole other religion that's here. So it can be a pretty comfortable place. We have schools that we go to and a lot of our students are at. And so that kind of piece there, you can get very kind of in the routine. This is how we do it. I sit in my same seat every week. We sing very similar songs. I know what to expect. And we're not really growing. We're not really being challenged in that way. And in some ways, then we just become even unknowingly a little bit prideful, like, oh, we do this well. We've seen this in conversations. I've certainly been guilty of it over the years. We think we do it best, and we're going to insult everybody else who does it differently. And so that's part of the complacency, too. It's really kind of the self-centered. We had a picture up of the guy in the rocking chair on the railroad tracks, but you're just not aware. You think, oh, of course, look at this, great. We got good children's programs. We got, you know, this going on with attendance. We got, a new building project. And meanwhile, we're really stagnant in our faith, or the enemy's working in these things because we're not being watchful. We're not being vigilant. We just think, oh, everything's great. We're going along well. So I think here in this area, especially having grown up in the Chicago area, here is much more of a, you'll walk into a place and you're like, oh, there's a Christian radio station on here. That would have been a rare, rare experience for me growing up where I did. That would have been shocking. Or even in the Christian Reformed Church, most people I encountered, worked with, they had no idea what a Christian Reformed Church was. But here, people know quite well, for better or for worse. So that level of comfort and sometimes ease, and even just assumption of course we go to church. Of course, this is what my family's always done. This is the way we've always done it. And you're not really, being watchful, even to thinking why we're doing the things we're doing, or maybe the way the enemy's trying to work in to twist those things, as he's always trying to do, toward our own selfish ends or away from the Lord's intentions. So I think it's certainly a threat that's there. And we can kind of really become, lazy, for a better word, in our faith, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's so important that we try and fight against this complacency, because that's kind of the whole thing with the complacency, is like, it's just not movement. There's no movement. There's no change. Mm-hmm. We're here. And so it is really important that we try and move and we try and learn and we try and grow. But also I feel like it's kind of important to make sure that as we're doing that we're not just looking for things to complain about. So then my next question would be something along the lines of, what's the difference between trying to be anti-complacent, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. and just looking for things to complain about?
Yeah, that's a good question, because sometimes we hear the word watchful or vigilant, and immediately I'm thinking like outside of myself, which some of that can be complaining. Some of it's valid, right? I mean, you look at the churches Jesus speaks to, and some of them had things, they were being attacked, right? And the church in Philadelphia is an example, perhaps. But that's where I can be like, oh, well, you know, the problem is, you know, Austin's doing this, you know, or oh, this other church over here is doing that. And we start complaining, or, well, maybe if other people in this church started doing it my way, rather than taking a look in the mirror first and foremost and saying, yeah, what do I need to be aware of? What are some of the ruts I'm getting in my own walk and my own faith? That we don't really self-complain, self-evaluation. So I think that can, making sure we're evaluating ourselves first before we're looking outside and blaming everything else. That's part of complacency, is it's not always that we don't see any danger. It's sometimes we don't see the real dangers.
And the danger is always someone else's fault, or someone else has to deal with that and not me.
Right. Yeah. So it could be like, well, we'd be a lot healthier if we were singing, you know, the music that I liked. Well, yeah, there could be some discussion there at a point, but that's probably not the real danger to the church. It's probably something else, and probably something we often don't want to identify because it'll hit home. And so I think that's where the complaining can come in, when we start being more watchful and where we start pointing fingers and we blame everything on everything else. And we're not first and foremost individually looking at ourselves, or then as a church, right? We can easily look at churches around us or other and be like, oh, yeah, well, that's what's wrong with the church today. They're all show and glitz and no substance. Or, oh, yeah, they, you know, they're doing this way. And then we're doing that as a church. We're not looking at ourselves, take the speck out of our brother's eye, but not take the plank out of our own.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a piece there. And the complacency, I think when you look at what we do for our jobs, it's more obvious because we tend to be even more watchful when it comes to those kind of things, unfortunately. But, you know, some here are in agriculture and farming. And, you know, if you had a great year, like a lot did this year with the soil and all that, and you said, well, yeah, great. Yeah, obviously we got this thing figured out. We're not going to do anything over the winter. We're not going to treat that soil. Probably not going to go as well. Or maybe it goes decent the first year, but then the next year it kind of gets progressively worse. And so with our faith, too, that could be even like, oh, I had a great year this year. I was really connected with the Lord. And so I'm just going to kind of coast, you know, or maybe I'm not going to look at anything different. I'm going to try to do the exact same thing. Well, things change, or now the Lord's going to lead me in a different direction. I say, no, it's got to be this way because this really worked well. And that is complacency as well. And sometimes our complaints about change also are signs of complacency. I mean, we don't just change for the sake of change. And sometimes ideas can be bad, certainly, but change is also part of growth often. And sometimes we need to understand the Lord's now calling us to this or to that ministry, or we can't always do the exact same thing we maybe did 25 years ago because, yeah, people are different and the needs are different. And so some of that's just the identifying. You can lament that things are different or ended. Like Sardis, their impact and influence was waning as a city and as a church, more than likely. And, you know, you lament that, but then, okay, what's God calling us now? We can't maybe just keep doing the exact same thing. So,
and then that actually tees right up perfectly into my next question. So kind of zooming back out again, you know, looking at how the American church may have been in a Sardis phase moving towards Philadelphia, as far as the level of influence the church has, as we move away from having influence and favor in the culture towards not, how can we do that well? What can we do to make that transition a healthy transition for our culture and for us?
Yeah, it takes a lot of wisdom. We talked about it a little bit Sunday night with Daniel, right? I mean, that's a more of an extreme case. Obviously, they've been taken captive and they're being pressed upon by the foreign culture there, by the Babylonians. But nevertheless, there's a lot of wisdom there. I think first and foremost, the lesson we take from Philadelphia is this call to remain faithful, because the temptation is when things start changing just to go along with it and to maybe cast aside our faith, to say, okay, we need to grab a little bit of something here or there along with Jesus. And kind of like we saw with the Israelites in the Old Testament, this works out. This can make us money. This can give us influence. We want to have that voice. So rather than, you know, boy, people are rejecting Jesus now. So maybe we need to adjust our, you know, our thoughts there. So, yeah, we're called to remain faithful, to persevere, to be true to who we are in Christ. At the same time, right, there's this, how do we then interact with the culture? And there's not just one specific way of doing that. There was a great book written some years ago about Christ and culture, and they kind of offered up these five different approaches to that, you know, whether it's Christ against culture, Christ kind of with culture, Christ transforming culture, all these different ideas. And it's still very relevant because it's just a thoughtful book, right? Yeah, yeah. It just fits in. But that we saw that, like, a lot of times our response right now is against, right, to resist. And there's certainly times for that, but that's almost the only way we respond, it seems like, from the church perspective now. And there's probably wiser ways in some cases that we could respond with. I mean, there's always things we could be learning. Maybe there's times when something could be transformed. Maybe there's times to say, okay, we can go along with this here. It's not negating who we are. It's not calling us to, go against who we are in Jesus Christ or something like that. So there's some wisdom there in discerning together what does this look like, right? And we could easily talk to brothers and sisters in other parts of the world who are very much in a position of being a minority or, of course, facing severe persecution for their faith. And how do you go about this? And, it's easy when you're not facing that to be like, well, you got to resist here and resist there and resist there. And it's not so easy when it's like, well, then we'd all be dead if that was the case. Or like, how do we maintain a witness? And I know that's extreme, but that, you know, can be true in some cases. But there's different points, like we saw with Daniel in that story, of maybe God opens a door to say, yeah, no, we know it's not going to make you happy, but we're not going along with that. But over here, you know, we're gonna go along with this. That's fine, kind of thing. So that wisdom of knowing, when to maybe resist, it's okay to go along with something that's maybe not ideal or the way it was before. And when just to realize, like, okay, our voice has been marginalized more. It's not listened to as much. How do we not just lament that, but how do we open the door so that we can be heard? I think you can look at the Apostle Paul. He talks one way to the church. He's often more strong with when he's writing letters to the church, but when he's dealing with those who are governmental authorities or like when the city of Athens, he talks with them a different way. He wants them to know Christ, come under that influence, but he's not speaking to them like, well, you know these things, and so you should live that way. He speaks to them like those who are living very much outside of that, and so how can I share this good news and so that you'd realize this is what God's doing in the world and then would realize there's a better way to live. So that's maybe an adjustment for us. Sometimes in our culture, we're still talking to everyone like, well, you know these things. You're Christian, aren't you? You're American. And that's less and less the case. We're talking to people who don't believe what we believe. So why in the world would we expect them to live the way we're living? It's one thing if Austin and I are talking to each other in the church. We should hold each other to that. We committed to this. We've said this is who we are. We believe these things. We got to hold each other accountable. But someone who's not in the faith, we're going to have to find a different way to be able to bring our voice into the conversation. Just telling them you should be doing this is not going to hold water because that's not where they're at right now. We have to show that we're interested, we want to be there, we want to engage, and then be able to achieve a level of maybe respect to have a voice.
Yeah. Well, and I think to kind of tack onto that last bit there, working on changing hearts, both our own and the culture's, before changing behavior. Mm. Because changing behavior, I mean, I'm not a parent, but I was told this by my parents that, you know, if they wanted me to do something and they wanted me to actually keep doing that thing, they had to convince me that I needed to do that thing for whatever reason. If it was just do this because I said so, that's not effective. Mm-hmm. That's not going to do it. And so similarly, I would think it would apply to, you know, if I'm talking with someone who's not a believer, who has no knowledge of why would he behave the way I behave?
Right. And most of us don't like being told what to do, especially by someone who's not close to us.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have that in me too. Like, well, because you're saying it this way, I'm probably going to do the opposite. You know, and so there's that natural stubbornness. And that's, like you said, for a long time, you know, I'm a pastor. For a lot of time, especially in small towns, if the pastor had this high level of respect and was probably the most educated person in town. And so you said something and it carried a great weight. And that wasn't always used well. A lot of times it was used well, but that's not the case anymore. People aren't going to be like, oh, wow, we're so thankful. It might be more opposition. Like, I can't believe you do this. You lead this kind of thing. And, there's more of that opposition now. So to be able to have a voice is going to take a little different approach and work, or maybe it was assumed before. Yeah, of course, let's talk about Christian values. That's not always going to be where someone's coming from now, or even has experienced, perhaps. So, yeah, just different things coming around, and it's not always the case, but it's more there than probably was for a lot of us when we were younger.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for your insight on that, Dan. To wrap us up, what are we talking about next week?
So, yeah, still Revelation 3, another one of these churches. The last one, Jesus speaks to the church in Laodicea. A pretty in-your-face kind of word to them. This, you could say if Sardis was bad, Laodicea is actually worse. Jesus doesn't have anything good to say about them and doesn't give any indication that there's anybody doing anything right there. This is the passage where Jesus talks about them being lukewarm, and he's going to vomit them out of his mouth. If things aren't careful.
Probably the last thing you want Jesus to say about
basically
you.
Basically, he's saying, you make me sick. So a pretty strong message. And yet, there's a lot of things here as we get to Laodicea that we need to think about. This is likely the most wealthy of the cities, the most important of the cities that Jesus writes to. And so especially as we look at ourselves in the West as Christians, as ones who do have, whether we want to admit it or not, a great deal of wealth, that is creating a culture there in the church of kind of self-sufficiency and maybe a little bit of smugness that is causing their Christian life to be not alive and not useful. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus is calling that out, and yet he has some very encouraging words too as he gets to the end of that message. When he gets to kind of the point of correction, he is speaking in a way to that the door would be open, that he's right there ready to come in and to bless them and to have them even sit on his throne with him. So, yeah, it'll be, I think, another message that can speak to us directly and kind of be an alert for us. Jesus means that, but he's speaking to us that we might turn to him and realize, we need to pay attention and we need to always be turning back to him away from ourselves as well. So, yeah, that's where we'll be this coming week. With Laodicea.
Nice. A lot of good stuff to look forward to. So thank you, Dan, so much again for your time. Thanks to all of you who have been listening with us. We're glad to be back, and we will see you again next time.